Well, good morning and welcome to Horizon and welcome to a series of conversations that we are calling Down to a Science. Now, I love this because so many times we think that God and science are not friends. In fact, they're probably enemies and never the twain shall meet. But I just happened to be blessed that in my family, my dad considers himself a mathematician and a theologian. And trying to fit those two things together, I learned growing up that actually the idea that the Bible and God don't get along with science is completely foreign to the Bible. In fact, it is offered to us that it's actually through science, through the beauty of things like biology, physics, even mathematics, that we can discover more about who we are and the world around us, but also more about who God is. And so today, in Down to a Science, it is Math Week. Who's excited? Like, I remember when I was a kid, like, and you know, God forgive me, but when you're like 10 years old and your parents make you sit by them at church and you're trying to pay attention, but this is way over my head and it just feels like church is boring, and now you're telling me we're doing math at church. 10-year-old me cannot handle that. So, relax, you do not need a graphing calculator. We're not doing any trigonometry today, no calc. But what we are going to do is we're going to look at the beauty of math. Because guys like Johann Sebastian Bach said that math was at the core of his compositions of music. How the pieces all fit together are mathematically arranged. Artists like M.C. Escher saw math through his work. He's the guy that made all the weird things where it's like the stairs are walking on the ceiling and stuff. And part of what we love about math is that it's logical. It makes sense. It should be provable. And if I use the right equation, I'll get the same answer every time. But as you're going to hear in the song that we're about to hear and see in the video that we'll watch after that, yeah, when you do the math, you can go so far as to estimate how many stars there are in the universe. But what about the questions that math can't answer? What about the questions that make you lay awake at night and wonder about things like eternity? Those questions that keep you up at night.
Here's a question that could literally keep you awake all night. How many stars are there in the universe? On a clear evening in the desert, without a telescope, we can see about 5,000 individual stars. All of them are located in the Milky Way, a fairly typical spiral galaxy with a stellar population somewhere between 100 billion and 400 billion stars. And the Milky Way is just a speck in the observable universe, where estimates range from 100 billion to perhaps as many as 2 trillion total galaxies. Now, let's do the math. Using conservative estimates, we'll multiply 100 billion galaxies times 10 billion stars per galaxy. The product is a whopping 1 billion trillion stars. And remember, that's a low-end estimation. To appreciate a number that large, we need some context. So let's try this. There are roughly 135,000 grains in 1 cubic inch of sand, and about 235 million in a cubic foot. While exact measurements are nearly impossible to determine, geographers estimate there are approximately 220,000 miles of coastline and 6 million square miles of sand desert on the surface of our planet. Using estimates like these, researchers at the University of Hawaii have calculated that in all the deserts and beaches of the world, there are something like 7.5 × 10⁻⁷ power, or more than 7 billion billion individual grains of sand. Again, an estimate like this is an educated guess, so to make some allowance for the difficulty of actually counting sand, let's increase the Hawaiian calculation by a factor of 10. Now that'll build you a lot of castles, but it's only a fraction of the total number of stars. Because when we compare the estimates of total sand to total stars, the stars outnumber the sand grains by at least 10 to 1. But that may not be the most amazing part of this story. You see, a single grain of sand, 4/100ths of an inch in diameter, contains approximately 500 billion billion individual atoms. That's more atoms in one grain than total grains of sand on the Earth, or stars in a billion Milky Way galaxies. Okay, before we power down our calculators, here's a final dose of big numbers. In a single drop of water, there are about 1.7 billion trillion individual H2O molecules. That means, in just a few large drops, the total number of molecules could exceed the total number of stars in the entire universe. So, what's our takeaway from these mathematical excursions into the basic structure of creation? Well, for starters, we live on a planet that's part of a cosmos unimaginably large and complex. And that planet is filled with countless atomic and molecular universes, inconceivably small, and often even more complex. And each of these physical realms, gigantic or microscopic, is held together every second of every hour of every day by the God who created everything. Remember that next time you're searching for scarab beetles in the Sahara Desert, or camping in South America under the breathtaking glow of the Milky Way, or just hanging out in the backyard, watching your wet dog launch 10,000 liquid universes on a summer afternoon.
Did you keep track of all those numbers? You can't, right? And that's kind of the point, that as you do this math, both the vastness of the universe and the minuteness of the universe is mind-blowing. And so we can calculate these things, and you get zeros and zeros and zeros and zeros. But you notice those words that were on the screen as it faded, that this was all created, visible and invisible, by a God. A God who wants to know you personally. And I don't know about you, but as I listen to that, it feels like we just shifted, right? Went from the concrete and the logical, right? Counting sand, estimating stars, where that's for scientists, and we can run the numbers, and we can pull out the calculators, and we put it through computers, right? But the Bible actually tells us that if God's thoughts could be counted, they would be more than the grains of sand. It tells us that God not only counts all the stars, he has named all of them. And it feels like there's a little bit of a shift from concrete, logical, scientific, measurable to, I mean, did he say invisible? Like it's almost this mystical, spiritual other thing over here that I don't have buttons for that on my calculator. So how do I wrap my head around these things? Because what I hear a lot of times is that when people approach spiritual things, they don't want to buy into it because I don't want to be gullible. I don't want to be tricked. If it can't be proven, then I'm not going to believe it just because this guy says so, that guy says so, or somebody thinks they've got a book. Right? And that there's this idea that to believe in God or to believe in Jesus, that when you talk about Easter coming up in a couple of weeks, to think that someone could actually rise from the dead, what you actually need to do is turn off your mind, just believe. But I think math, believe it or not, math is actually going to help us with this. Because in the mathematical world, it is not just the equations, but it is looking at things like proof, truth, and using your mind. And what's amazing to me is that when Jesus was asked, of all the stuff that's written in the Bible before Jesus shows up, so like if you didn't know, it basically comes in like two parts. The Old Testament was before Jesus' life. The New Testament is like Jesus' life and then stories about his followers after he goes back to heaven. So somebody asks Jesus, of everything in the whole Bible that they already have at that time, what is the most important law? What's like the most important thing God gave us? And this is how Jesus answers. He says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. Because there's an emotional element to this. With all your soul. Because there's a spiritual element to this. With all your mind. That there's an intellectual element to loving God. And with all your strength. And so what I want you to hear is, not only does the Bible not say, turn off your mind and just believe, Jesus himself actually said, the most important thing in the entire Old Testament is to love God with your heart, soul, strength, and your mind. To fully engage your intellect in how you explore and get to know who God is. And so I heard one guy put it this way, you want to use the same mind to explore God that you use to complete that sale every day of the week. The same mind that you use to perform surgery. The same mind that you use to study for all those tests. The same mind that you use to relate to others. The same mind that you use to try to guess what your spouse is thinking right now. Right? Like, I can't see it, but she's thinking something, right? Use that mind. Engage your mind in discovering not only the universe around us, but the possibility of the God who's created it. Because what we discover then is when we look at the beauty of math, when you do the math, you discover that you can have an open mind about things that seem impossible. And of course, the Bible says that a number of times. Hey, there is stuff that is impossible with human beings that is possible for God. And if you just take that at face value, it sounds like, yeah, right, sure, of course. And yet, we actually see some of this in the mathematical world. And so I want to give you an example of this. Here I have a paint can. Now, if you've ever painted anything, you know that the amount of paint inside this can could paint, like, the entire room, right? Maybe the first coat. It's certainly enough paint to paint the can itself, right? So, here's a mathematical truth for you. The volume of paint an object can hold is more than enough to paint the object, okay? Except, now I want you to imagine a different shape. I have here a horn that my daughter Belle so generously loaned me for today. I am not allowed to blow it, but I am allowed to show you. Now, imagine that you fill this with paint. Well, what we know is that the paint that this would be filled with is more than enough to paint the outside of this horn. But now, imagine a horn, the outside of which extends infinitely, but for which the inside is finite. Meaning, as the outside continues to expand, the inside stops expanding. Now, that sounds impossible. What that would mean is that no matter if you filled it all the way to the brim, the paint inside would never be enough to paint the object, because this horn goes on forever on the outside, but not on the inside. Ridiculous, right? Except that in math, this is what is known as Gabriel's horn. And the way you get this, don't worry, you don't need your graphing calculator, so for those of you who love math, go home and do this on your own time. If you take y equals 1 over x, and you graph that, and rotate it around the x-axis, you get what is called Gabriel's horn, an object with infinite surface area, even though it has finite volume. So rather than turn off your brain, math actually shows you that things that sound impossible might actually be possible, And this is one example that has been proven. But what about things that can't be proven? Right? What about those questions where you don't have a simple formula like y equals 1x and then rotate it? Well, if you like to ask those kinds of questions, I'd like to introduce you to a man named Kurt Gödel. Now, Kurt, as a little boy, his family called him Mr. Why, because he was always asking questions, and it was never good enough for him to know what the answer was. He wanted to know why that was the answer. He always wanted proof. And you may not be terribly familiar with very many famous mathematicians. I know I'm not. My dad is. But this is one that he pointed me to, and as you research this, it's important for you to know, Time called Kurt Gödel the greatest mathematician of the 20th century. So this is not like digging up some random mathematician who has a couple weird ideas and let's use that to make a point. This is the greatest mathematician of the 20th century. And his life's journey was interesting because he was always seeking for more information. And part of his life was that as he studied, he wanted to prove why things were provable. And so he became a brilliant student, he became a brilliant teacher. But life isn't all fun and math, because he became very good friends with someone you do probably know named Einstein. And Einstein, later in his life, he said that he came to the university not to work on his own stuff, but just so he would have a chance to talk to Gödel. But Gödel's life was hard, because there was a point in his life where his two primary mentors, the people that he learned the most from, both died, I think within a year of each other. And in case you didn't know about the seedy underbelly of the math world, one of those mentors was assassinated by another one of his math students. Like, what is the motivation there? I do not know. But he lost both of his mentors basically at the same time, and then a very prestigious position that he had earned was taken from him because Nazi Germany determined that he had failed the race test, which is basically that when they interviewed him, he did not believe that Nazism was a good form of government. He did not believe Jews should be treated that way, and so he lost the prestigious position that he had worked so hard for. That was part of what drove him actually to move to the United States, where he met Einstein, among others. And throughout this season of his life, he figured out the thing that he is probably the most famous for. Now remember, this is a guy who wanted the answer to everything. He wanted to know why. He wanted to see it proven. And yet the thing that Kurt Gödel is remembered for is something called Gödel's incompleteness theorem. So what he discovered in the world of mathematics is that as we are proving things to be true, those axioms, those statements, are always built on other statements. This is true because this and this are true. And that when you go down far enough, there will always be statements that we know are true, but are unprovable. In fact, he showed that there are some statements that are specifically true because they're unprovable. Now, this threw the math world into a complete spin, because every mathematician since like Archimedes has been trying to work to prove everything. And if we just do enough math, we can calculate all of it. Everything is manageable within math. Right? Like hypothetically, if you had enough data, even the path of a tornado, you could calculate. We just don't have enough data, but you wait until we do. And then Gödel shows up and says, "You know what? I have wonderful and terrible news for everyone." Eventually, you get down to these statements that we know are true. It's not that we think they're true. There are things that we know are true that can't be proven by any science known to man. Any science within our world. That's Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And so Kurt Gödel was a man who actually, because of these kinds of studies, he became more and more convinced that the God of the Bible was the only true God. In fact, one of the things that he worked on later in his life was even an attempt to prove the existence of God, which is pretty compelling, but others poke holes in it. But that tells you that the greatest mathematician in the 20th century did not have to turn off his brain to believe that God was real, to believe that the Bible had a message that was worth him listening to. but how does that help me? How does that help me when I'm lying awake at night and I'm asking questions about eternity and questions about life and questions about who I am? I remember a few years ago, I know some of you are in a group right now reading the book Purpose Driven Life. So I went through that book at a study here at Horizon myself a few years ago. And I thought one of the most interesting conversations that we had there was you get to this chapter where it starts talking about eternity. And I remember really struggling with eternity at one point in my life because I am logical and I want everything to line up and I want to see how all the pieces fit into place. And then the Bible tells you about this thing that has no beginning and it has no end. Like, I understand the words you use to describe that, but I cannot wrap my head around it. And one of the other guys in the group, it was the same thing. It was like, I remember the day that his main question was, how can I believe something if I can't understand it? And if I was going to tell my kids, for example, that they should believe it, but I can't explain it to them, am I really supposed to think that it's not just try to be a good person, live a good life, but that that actually might have an impact on where I spend eternity? Well, interestingly, math can help us wrap our heads around this concept as well. The picture on screen is something called a fractal. This is probably the most famous one. There are a number of them, but this is what's known as Mandelbrot's set. And same thing for all the math whizzes out there. It's an equation that when you graph the points of that equation, it draws this picture. But what is unique about a fractal that you begin to notice is that you see kind of that round shape, and then in front of it, there's another one just like it. And actually, on the tip of that is another one just like it. And what happens is the further that you zoom into the fractal, you see it repeat itself again and again and again onto infinity. And there are literally people, you can go on YouTube and see this, trying to work the world record of how far they've zoomed into a fractal because it's just going to go forever. And you can have like a 20-hour video of YouTube just pushing further into this fractal and seeing the same thing again and again and again. And yet it fits on the screen. It's a little bit like the number pi. Like, I can look at a circle, and I know pi is related to it, but how weird to think that pi is 3.141592, and then it just goes on forever. And I can't fully wrap my head around it, but I know it works. I know it helps us draw circles, build cars, anything else that we need it for. And so math can actually help us wrap our minds around this idea that there is something, that it is possible, that there are things that we can know, things that we can believe, like eternity, that it's okay if I can't fully wrap my head around it. That doesn't mean I'm giving up my intellectual integrity, that it may actually be more intelligent, more brilliant, to allow for the possibility of things that are infinite like that. So early after Christ's life, one of his most famous followers, it's a guy that we know as the Apostle Paul. He was trying to help his own friends wrap their minds around this thing, because then you start to hear, again, it's like, I'm hearing the logical, I'm seeing your equations, fractals are cool, but I'm supposed to believe in an invisible God. And I'm having trouble bridging that gap. So Paul's trying to help his friends bridge that gap by talking to them about the visible and the invisible. And so these are actually the same verses that we saw at the end of that video about the stars in a book called Colossians. He writes, "For by him," speaking of Jesus, "all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist." Now, I know there's a lot going on in that, like, that's like one, two long sentences. But what this is saying about Jesus is that all things, through him, for him, by him, and he's holding it all together. Now, that's a pretty big claim. And in some ways, it could break down pretty quickly if it says that there are things that are visible and invisible, and I'm still thinking, nah, let's just talk about the visible world. Let's talk about the five senses. Let's talk about the things that science can measure and the experiments that we can run. Because a lot of times, that's where we default to as the only things you can really know exist. But what if it's possible that the invisible exists too? Because when you do the math, you actually realize that you can have eyes open to things that are invisible. So I'll give you a couple examples of this. One easy one is wind. Right? We hear that one a lot. You can't see wind. But you can see what wind does, right? Or how about this one? Have you ever seen gravity? Well, no, but you know it exists because it's working right now. That's why we're all sitting down, right? It's the reason the stool stays where it is, right? So just in the physical world, there are already things we know you will never see. You will never see wind and you will never see gravity, and yet we know that they're there. But let's take it out of the physical. What about peace? Have you ever seen peace? When you have a day that you feel so anxious and someone gives you a word of encouragement and a sense of calm comes over you, then your thoughts change. Oh, you feel it, right? You feel the effects of it, just like the wind. But have you ever seen peace? Have you ever seen love? Oh, you see the effects of it. But what does it actually look like? And so I give you those examples just to show you that we regularly believe things that we can't actually see. We regularly believe that they are real, that they are at work, and that they are some of the most important things in our lives. And nobody has to turn off their brain to believe in gravity or love, right? When we engage our brains, we realize that makes even more sense. But what if there's more than just wind and gravity and love that we can't see? So I'm going to introduce you to another mathematician. This guy's name is Edwin Abbott Abbott. Not a typo. His parents really did that to him. Thanks a lot, Mom and Dad. See, Edwin was another guy who was always asking questions, and he was most famous as a mathematician and for his geometry. And so the piece that is carried down through history for him is he wrote this book called Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions. He literally wrote a geometry novel, and it became a bestseller. So, like, you'll find this book all over the place, but part of what he was trying to accomplish was to demonstrate for people that we've got to be willing to think beyond our own three dimensions, think beyond our own senses. And so essentially the story of Flatland, as Edwin writes it, is that one day there's a square, and this square lives in Flatland. So literally on a 2D plane, no third dimension, no concept of three dimensions, which means if you think about a square, if you lay it flat into two dimensions, all you would see is the edge of it. And that's how all of his friends looked to him. Everywhere he looked, all he could see was the edge of the other shapes because he only lives in two dimensions. Then one day, a sphere comes to visit him from the third dimension. And at first, he just hears a voice. And the voice says something like, I'm above you. Well, there's no above in two dimensions. There's forward, backward, side to side. There's no up. There's no down. He just hears this disembodied voice. Then the sphere says, hold on, I'll show you. And the sphere enters into his world, into Flatland. Which you can imagine, as the sphere moves through the plane, the first thing he would see would just be a tiny dot. But as he passed further through, that dot becomes a small circle. The circle expands until he's halfway through. And then as he keeps moving, it's weird. The circle gets small again, turns into a dot, and disappears. And he checks, all the doors are locked, all the windows are locked. I don't know what that circle was or how it got in here, and I can still hear its voice, and this is weird. Now, to you and I, it's easy to understand, right? Because we can picture three dimensions, and you can picture a sphere passing through a flat plane. But to the square, this is impossible. So as the story goes on, the sphere actually lifts the square out of Flatland, takes him on a wonderful flight through three dimensions, tells him all of the wonderful things that are beyond him that he could never see or fathom, and yet they're real. And when the square gets back to Flatland, he says, people need to know about this. And so he tells all of his friends as best as he can, well, it's like a circle. Well, it's like a lot of circles. It's like an infinite number of circles. Nobody believes him. And then you and I are sitting here like, oh, those people of Flatland, right? Well, Edwin was trying to do two things. One, he was encouraging other mathematicians, other people doing geometry, we've got to be willing to keep our minds open to like fourth dimensional math, fifth dimensional math. Again, these are guys who are fully locked in with their brains. But the other thing that he was trying to do was he was trying to encourage people to consider God. In fact, Edwin himself became a Christ follower during his life. And after his life, his wife talked about how much he loved to sit in bed just reading his Bible to better understand the God that he believed in. Because part of what he wanted people to think about was, if I'm only looking at what's here, what I can see, taste, smell, touch, is it possible that I'm actually missing out on something that is even more real? That is, in some sense, it's like another dimension. It's on a higher plane. And we think because I can't see it or hear it, it's not real and I don't want to talk about it. He's like, then you're acting like the people who live in Flatland. But what if it's possible that God is there? And what would it look like? What would it look like if God entered our world? If God stepped down into three dimensions from whatever that spiritual realm is like? Maybe you see where this is going, but that is exactly how Paul describes it in that same letter. He puts it this way. He, Jesus, is the image of the invisible God. That is literally how the Bible talks about Jesus coming to earth, is that this is God stepping into Flatland. This is God stepping into our world. This is God revealing himself to us in a way that we can actually see, that people could shake Jesus' hand, that they could give him a hug. If you want to know what God is like, look at Jesus. And if that's possible, then no wonder he could walk on water. No wonder he could appear in rooms where the doors were locked and the windows were closed. Right? Those things that sound impossible because like people can't do that. Hey, what if he's not people? What if he's God in the flesh? And it's hard to wrap our heads around, but if Jesus is fully human and fully God, you know what? Maybe that's why he can take a little loaf of bread and feed 5,000 people. Maybe that's why he can heal people that we have no cure for. Maybe that's why he can tell us what the future holds. Maybe that's why he can die on that cross and raise himself again. To put it mathematically, it's because he's coming from another dimension. You see, what I want you to be able to just wrap your mind around a little bit today is that I know, because I feel it too, and I've had these conversations with my dad. Like he is brilliant mathematician. Like I know just enough that I can follow half of the conversation when we talk about math. But he also loves God deeply. And that's one of the first places that I learned. You do not have to turn off your mind to believe that God is real. But you notice that Paul is not just talking vaguely about the sense that God or something like God might be out there. It's incredibly specific that Jesus is this God, that Jesus is the only God. In fact, when he gives the motivation for this entire thing, in verse 19 of that same letter, he says that it pleased the Father that in him, Jesus, all the fullness of God should dwell, and by him to reconcile all things to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Boy, that just got awfully religious, didn't it? And yet this is exactly the message that the Bible wants to bring. That even as you consider the math of the visible and the invisible, that when you begin to wrap your mind around the possibility of God, it is not just to hold him at some distant arm's length who doesn't care about me, but maybe he's out there somewhere. God is saying, I want to reconcile you to myself. I love you so much, but the things that you've messed up, mixed up, and gotten wrong in your life have separated us. And there's no way for you to make it up to God. And so God says, I'm coming to Flatland. I will step into your world. I will die for your mistakes so that I can reconcile our relationship and live with you for eternity. That's how the pieces all come together in the big story of the Bible. Because God loved you so much, that was worth it to him. And so here's the invitation I think that God is offering us. Love God with your heart and mind. That it is actually reasonable. You can believe things that seem unbelievable without sacrificing your intellectual integrity. Just ask Godel. That you can know truth and know it's true, even if there's no mathematical, scientific proof for it, without turning off your brain, without being gullible or being tricked, that you can believe in things even if you can't see them, when you feel the effects of God's peace and God's love in your life. A couple of years ago, a friend of mine here at Horizon made the decision to, how would I put this? Not stop asking questions. He's definitely still asking questions. But to take the questions that had been answered, save the questions he didn't have answers for yet, and make the decision to become a follower of Christ. To sit down in that moment and say, God, I believe that I have sinned. Like, I've done things that go against your perfect standard, and I need forgiveness. And Jesus, I want you to be my forgiver. Right? It's that simple to get started. And he still has a lot of questions, and so it was sometime after becoming a Christ follower, Joe took me out to lunch, and we were just talking about, hey, here's something I struggle with. He said, you know, there are 7 billion people on the planet. Am I really supposed to believe that God hears me pray for more patience in traffic? Like, he has got to have bigger things to do than that, right? Like, God has to be busy somewhere else. Like, there's famine and there's natural disasters and there's wars going on. And then I'm like, Lord, help me not hate this guy in front of me. Amen. And I'm like, well, actually, Joe, he does listen. But I thought, you know, one of the things that helps us wrap our minds around that, like if we all stopped right now and everybody in this room and everybody watching this online, we all started praying, he can listen to each of you individually. And one of the things that helps me with that is think about if there are billions and billions and billions and billions of stars, and he knows them all by name, and he can hold it all together, don't you think he knows you by name too? And then he wants to listen when you talk to him. In fact, there's actually a page in the Bible in a place called Psalm 8. So the book called the Psalms is just a collection of songs that are written to God. And one of them is by a man we know as King David, one of the most famous kings in history, who was not only like a political leader, but also like a spiritual leader for God's people. And in Psalm 8, he's wrestling with who he is, who God is, and how those two things fit together. And he says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him? It's just like Joe's question. The universe is so big, who am I that you even pay attention to me, God? And yet captured in that same psalm, that same poem, is the reality that he is mindful of you. And that it's actually when I look at the stars that I see someone beyond myself and I see who I am. Would you take time this week to look at the stars and read Psalm 8? If you're feeling brave, maybe even try talking to God about it. And I know it's like still kind of winter in Cincinnati, so a lot of times the skies can be cloudy. But if you find a clear night to look at the stars, and remember, you can only see about 5,000 of the billions. And remember that the God who knows the names of the stars knows your name too. Can I pray for you? God, thank you for this time that we've gotten to share today. Lord, I just pray that you would speak to each one of our own hearts in a way that we can sense, even though it may not be visible, even though there may not be an equation for it, that just like wind and gravity and love and peace, that we would have a sense of your love for us, even as we look at the stars. And Lord, we will ask that in Jesus' name. Amen. Hey, two more things I want to make sure that you know about, which are really two more ways to continue to explore exactly how much God loved you, because at this time of the year, we celebrate his resurrection. And so we're doing a Good Friday service. This is going to be an online-only service option that you can watch on Good Friday, where we're talking about what it means that Christ died for us. And in the next 2 days, on both Saturday and Sunday after that, we're celebrating Easter services. And so we would love for you to come. You do need tickets for that. They are complimentary, always complimentary, but that helps us make sure we have room for all of you and your friends and your family. And on Saturday, if you come to those Saturday Easter services, there's also Eggstravaganza, which is like an awesome party for families and kids to come and check out. So there's more information about all of that on our website. But the reason we do it is meant to be a gift to you, to your family, to your friends, as you explore and understand the God who loves science. Thank you for coming today. Hope to see you back next week.